best of times, the worst of crimes. The crowds dispersed at Carthage, and a martyr was made. Hiram Smith lay dead, leaving 8 children and 3 wives. His brother Joseph Smith was also dead, leaving 4 to 13 children, depending on how good of a geneticist that Ugo Perego is, with a baby on the way with Emma, and anywhere from 28 to 49 wives, depending on whose list you pull from.
He only left one wife, Brian, because William Clayton is a dirty fraud. One pure, virtuous, perfect companion of his youth, and not any other.
We're not joking. Just ask Joseph Smith III, or Richard, or Pamela Price, or, you know, the nice filmmakers of that new motion picture with the cool, repurposed Praise to the Man lyrics. They'd be happy to set you straight.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Okay, I know we are sometimes silly on this podcast. We can't help it because both Brian and I have grown up under the weight of these stories and Mormonism. So we're very familiar with all the characters, and it's hard not to rib them a little. They do some dumb stuff a lot. This podcast is basically Brian and I just gossiping about our ancestors. And Mormonism to me is a village, and we like telling the stories of those who live in our little village.
Mormonism is more than just a village, it's a family village. And, you know, just like in your own family, if a stranger talks crap about them, you get upset. It's like if someone makes fun of your mom. Yeah, maybe she might drive you crazy sometimes, but some other dude better not be talking about your mom. Now, if it's a sibling or a cousin, that's a little different story. In Mormonism, just making fun of our own big collective family. And, you know, hi, Mom, whenever you make it to this episode.
Your mom listens to our podcast? Hi, Brian's mom. You've raised a fine lad. Okay. Back to business. But today we're going to try to have a more somber tone.
Do you hear the somberness?
Someone's outside beating the somber drum, getting us ready to go. But mostly because we're trying to give dignity to a story that, for better or worse, has impacted millions of people in real ways. Even though Brian and I have heard this story so many times, it's hard not to take it seriously sometimes. It really is an important story. That's why we've heard it so much. It's impacted everything. So today we're going to talk about what grief is, how you make a martyr, and the cost of things like passion, faith, zealotry, democracy, love, and even violence. We're going to talk about the immediate aftermath of the murders of Joseph and Hiram Smith.
You know, sometimes it's hard to be serious when you see your ancestors making bad choices. We, of course, have the benefit of hindsight, but seeing them as real, flawed people helps us see our own world the same, and that's important. And doing this helps us to not repeat the past, hopefully. And in the case of the deaths of Joseph and Hiram Smith, we really don't want to repeat that. But sadly, repeats all the time. This arc of Joseph Smith's story is often played out within different Mormon communities. And it gives us another perspective of the past, how the same thinking, the same feelings can happen in our present. And our ancestors lived these stories in their present. So let's try and get in that mindset for a minute. Let's pretend like we don't have the knowledge of what happens after Joseph Smith is killed. Let's put ourselves in the headspace of Mormons who are on the ground in Nauvoo 1844.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me.
There are 25 miles between Carthage and Nauvoo. On the afternoon of June 27th, 1844, Samuel Smith, younger brother to Joseph and Hiram Smith, mounted his horse and braved a hot, sticky summer rain barreling towards Carthage. Sam was determined to reach his brothers before harm befell them. As the Hamilton Hotel came into sight, he heard a musket fire in the distance. But he was too late. He handed his reins to the hotel proprietor and ran full speed towards the jail. He entered the south entrance, and there he found Joseph Smith, his older brother, whose body was blocking the stairs, brought inside to avoid further mutilation or harm. Up the stairs, past Joseph, Samuel found Hiram, another older brother, dead on the floor, and Willard Richards appeared from the doorway holding a bloody John Taylor.
And Samuel actually wouldn't live long himself after the deaths of his brothers. Hold on to him for a minute, because we'll talk about him in an upcoming episode. But this could not have been an easy thing to see, right? You go upstairs, you go in this building, you find two of your brothers dead. So he gets the bodies onto a wagon, and then he helps Willard Richards and John Taylor get the hell out of Carthage.
It's good enough for me. I was good enough for Billy Burroughs. I was good enough.
After their violent murders at the hands of vigilante justice, air was taken out of the sails of many Mormon critics. Had the mob that killed Joseph and Hiram in Carthage gone too far? They had cut off the head of the snake of Mormonism by murdering the prophet, so would Mormonism go away or die? Now might be a good time to talk about the FLDS, of course.
Is it ever not a good time to talk about the FLDS?
It's always a good time.
I would argue no. There's never a bad time. A good case study of Nauvoo can be made through the lens of our Mormon cousins to the south, the FLDS, the Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, uppercase. When we talk about them, we're talking about Warrenites, the group that follows Warren Jeffs with the prairie dresses, the awesome hair. You know what we're talking about. Not to be confused with other Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, lowercase. Now, this is the group in all the scary documentaries, the ones we hear about terrible stories of abuse, family separations that are all coming out.
I hear a lot of talk in the Exmo world of what it would take for Mormonism to go away, right? Everyone's always getting around talking about the future of Mormonism. What would it take to get the church to go away? And when Exmos talk about Mormonism, mostly they're meaning the LDS, the mainstream church, not to be confused with the FLDS, Warren Jeffs' group, the Warrenites, like Brian just talked about.
Also, not to be confused with the RLDS group, which stays in the Midwest and we'll talk about more. Not confusing at all. My personal favorite, the TLDS, the Tall Latter-day Saints. Such a solid group. And it doesn't get enough press, honestly. Like, when was the last time you heard about the TLDS?
High on a mountaintop.
See, thank you. That is our theme song.
Whenever people opine about Mormonism disappearing, I wish they'd, like, honestly, watch our Warrenite friends, the FLDS. There are some applicable comparisons here, and no, you don't have to roll your eyes. I'm not invoking the Mormon Godwin's Law by comparing the FLDS to mainstreamers here. It's applicable because it works. Before their prophet was arrested in 2008, the group had around 10 to 12,000 members living in one city alone. So population-wise, it's actually not dissimilar to Nauvoo 1844. For both the FLDS and early Mormonism, the outside public saw their leader as perverse and corrupt, and the followers to be dangerous zealots. There are a lot of similarities, and of course, my mainstream friends, there are a lot of important differences too.
One of those differences is Warren Jeffs was arrested, not killed like Joseph Smith. But, in a sense, law enforcement cut off the head of the FLDS by putting Warren Jeffs in prison. Though Warren still has some followers, maybe 2,000, it's really kind of hard to tell these days. Arresting him obviously did have a huge impact. Law enforcement then began arresting other FLDS leaders on all sorts of charges, and having those guys locked up resulted in a lot of people leaving their church. So, outsiders hoping to get rid of the FLDS had a good crack at it by cutting off the head of the snake.
Yes, I know this is reductive. There are a lot of reasons why people left the FLDS church around this time, but they really were all spurred by the catalyst of the rest of Warren Jeffs, or I should say most of them have been spurred by the catalyst, which we will talk about well into the future, but you really are watching a church crumble in real time. However, like this new season will illustrate, cutting off the head of a snake doesn't guarantee the death of the movement, and if anything, it cauterizes it.
I would say it's the answer to this question. What happens when Hydra moves down to the creek? Stay tuned, I guess.
Has a lot of fun in the water.
Oh boy, just lots of bazillions of breakoff groups. I mean, you know, you hear stories about new prophets from the group popping up, new movements, I mean, the two of us, we watched one happen in front of us, you know, that kind of thing. So killing Joseph Smith didn't end Mormonism. If anything, it just kind of confused it.
Again, I really wish more people interested in the future of Mormonism writ large would study what's happening with FLDS right now, because it's a fascinating microcosm of so many things, not just the Mormon movement. But there's a case to be made for getting rid of the leader, as the thousands of FLDS who left the church and religion altogether demonstrates. But killing a man doesn't mean that you kill his ideas. Ditto for putting him in jail. And it's the ideas that stick around.
And now another way in which Nauvoo differs is that the mobs at Carthage could have reached an alternate end to choose your own adventure. They could have ended up with a mass exodus of people instead leaving Mormonism if they had let Joseph Smith be tried in a court of law and then sit in prison. But they didn't. They made a martyr out of him, pretty much guaranteeing his ideas would be around, I don't know, forever.
Killing Joseph provides a sort of mimetic exit of the tensions that were building up in 1844 and all the years prior. All of this tension and violence of Mormonism was definitely escalating. But the energy would just shift to new movements, new prophets and new claims of authority, new trauma, same persecution narrative. Joseph Smith was dead, but his ideas were violently reborn.
Word of the murders reached Emma Smith and Nauvoo on June 28th, the next day. We mentioned this statement that Willard Richards wrote in the martyrdom episode, but let's put it on repeat here. Quote, Carthage Jail, 8.05 o'clock p.m., June 27th, 1844. Joseph and Hiram are dead. Taylor wounded, not very badly. I am well. Our guard was forced, as we believe, by a band of Missourians from 100 to 200. The job was done in an instant, and the party fled towards Nauvoo instantly. This is as I believe it. The citizens here are afraid of Mormons attacking them. I promise them no. W. Richards, John Taylor.
We mentioned that John Taylor had been shot up a bunch, but he didn't want his family to worry, so he minimized his wounds in that message.
Did he minimize them later on? Remind me, in Utah.
I'm pretty sure they had their own brass band when they came to Utah.
He made up for it later.
As for Thomas Ford, he arrived at Carthage Jail shortly before midnight. Remember, he's the governor at the time. And anyone that was hanging around Carthage, he sort of orders to disperse. He was concerned that Mormons would burn the city to the ground, and he worried, rightly so, about a civil war. He had Richards, who wasn't shot up at all, because he was hiding behind the door the whole time.
In a heroic fashion.
Oh, Willie Richards. He has him write and send Emma a note, sort of directing her to tell the Mormons in Nauvoo to stand down. He says, don't rush out of the city. Don't rush to Carthage. Please de-escalate this. So when Emma receives word from Thomas Ford, she does what Thomas Ford says. She issued a proclamation to the people to remain quiet and peaceable. And it's interesting to see that dynamic, because I don't think that's how Joseph would have responded if Thomas Ford sent that letter, right? Emma Smith, she just had a different strategy. Hers was always peace.
And cornbread. Peace and cornbread. So after the murders, everyone just scatters from the scene. The bodies of Joseph and Hiram are taken back to Nauvoo in two open wagons that next day, June 28th. Each wagon contained a rough oak casket covered with leaves and pine boughs to shade it from the sun. It was summer, and transporting bodies in that's not easy. They decayed faster, so they speed up the procession, get it done as quick as possible. As they get closer to Nauvoo, they were met by this big entourage. The Nauvoo brass band leads the wagon with an honor guard of 12 men, that kind of thing.
In the book Mormon Enigma, Newell and Avery paint such a poignant picture of what the community sort of experienced when they were grieving together. Thousands of people line the streets. Many of them are crying. That must have been an interesting thing to see. Alan Stout, a former Danite, ached for revenge as he stood with the crowd. This is his quote. I there and then resolved in my mind that I would never let an opportunity slip unimproved of avenging their blood. I knew not how to contain myself, and when I see one of the men who persuaded them to give up to be tried, I feel like cutting their throats yet. End quote. And also in Mormon Enigma, they point out the twist that Emma, not Reynolds Cahoon, not Hiram Kimball, would ultimately get blamed for getting Joseph to come back to Nauvoo after fleeing. I'm sure her being a woman and, oh, what else? An apostate, i.e. not following Brigham Young, had nothing to do with the story being blamed on her.
When the bodies arrived in Nauvoo, it was a tragic scene. One of the most dramatic accounts we have comes from Valete Kimball. Quote, I saw the lifeless corpses of our beloved brethren when they were brought to their almost distracted families. I witnessed their tears and groans, which was enough to rend the heart of an adamant. Every brother and sister that witnessed the scene felt deeply to sympathize with them. Yea, every heart is filled with sorrow, and the very streets of Nauvoo seem to mourn. Close quote. The bodies were brought to Emma's doorstep, and when they were brought inside, the door closed behind them.
Mormon Enigma has so many great accounts of what the mood was like in Nauvoo following the deaths. They tell the story of non-Mormon B.W. Richmond, who was a guest in the Mansion House after the Carthage murders. Apparently, Lucy Smith approached him when he walked into the room, and she grabbed him with both of her hands, saying, "Why did they shoot my dear children?" In another room, Richmond saw Joseph's children, Julia and Joseph, Alexander and Frederick, who were like huddled together in this mass, quote, mingling their grief in one wild scream of childish despair.
Emma Smith is found sitting in a chair sobbing uncontrollably. John P. Green, who is a friend of the family, lays his hands on her head and tries to offer a blessing of comfort. Emma just sobs, asking why Joseph was dead, why were her children without a father, why was she a widow? Newell and Avery write, quote, Green assured her that the sorrow she bore would be the crown of her life. Emma lifted her head. My husband was my crown.
Heartaches, heartaches. My loving you meant only heartaches. Your kiss was such a sacred thing.
Mormon newspapers, The Times and Seasons, and Nauvoo Neighbor published an announcement of the deaths and a eulogy for Joseph and Hiram. So they published this death announcement and this eulogy, but because it's, you know, a crazy time, it's hastily composed, and then they throw it and squish it in a new edition of the Doctrine and Covenants that was being prepared. It appeared as section 111 and now section 135. And this is the famous statement that has caused a lot of Mormons some conflicts in their Christianity. You know how it goes, quote, Joseph Smith, the prophet and seer of the Lord, has done more, save Jesus only, for the salvation of men in this world than any other man that has ever lived in it, and will be classed among the martyrs of religion, and the reader in every nation will be reminded that the Book of Mormon and this Book of Doctrine and Covenants of the Church cost the best blood of the 19th century to bring them forth for the salvation of a ruined world, end quote.
And yeah, keep that idea of the relationship of Joseph Smith to Jesus in your head for just a minute. We'll talk about that. Mark Scherer writes in his excellent History of Community of Christ about how Dimmick Huntington, William Marks, and William Huntington washed the bodies, got them ready, gave them new clothes and shrouds. The stink in that room got so bad they eventually had to burn tar, vinegar, and sugar to knock it back a little bit. George Cannon, who was the father of Mr. Neckbeard himself, George Q, created molds of Joseph and Hiram's faces called death masks. And then over the years, various different impressions were made from them. One set hangs on the walls of my basement museum archives, for example.
Brian, you had those in your bedroom at one point, so...
With a pink glow on them. Yeah. So this is fun. Friend of the podcast, Ryan Roos, probably knows more about death masks than anyone on earth. And he has been encouraged to write something up on them because they are extremely interesting.
Isn't there like a death mask museum in Holland or something?
I know it was a big thing at the time. That wouldn't surprise me.
I feel like there is. I mean, somewhere over the pond.
Oh, interesting. Oh, that would be fun to go see.
Yeah, it's a total Victorian thing.
Mm-hmm.
As is hair art, and I love hair art.
Somebody was just telling me they went to the DUP museum and saw the things there and was grossed out. I was like, those are awesome.
It's like they take it from all of their ancestors, mm-hmm. and then they turn it into flowers. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
And the ring idea and the coffin canes that have them in there, that's just cool.
Mormons are weird. We're just weird. Okay. Anyway, back to the story. So before the bodies were allowed to be shown to the public, Emma Smith was first given the honor of seeing them. And I'll let Linda Newell and Val Avery bring us in because it's just great. Quote, Emma tried several times to walk across the room, but each time she fainted. Finally, a friend helped her from the room. Then Mary Fielding Smith entered with her four children. Remember, she is Hiram's widow. She trembled at every step and nearly fell, but reached her husband's body and kneeled down by him, clasped her arm around his head, turned his pale face upon her heaving bosom, and then a gushing, plaintive wail burst from her lips. "Oh, Hiram, Hiram, have they shot you, my dear Hiram? Are you dead? Oh, speak to me, my dear husband. I cannot think you are dead, my dear Hiram."
B.W. Richmond, the non-Mormon observer we mentioned a minute ago, described this sad display, quote, "Her grief seemed to consume her, and she lost all power of utterance. Her two daughters and the two young children clung some to her body, falling prostrate upon the corpse and shrieking in the wildness of their wordless grief."
Emma was then brought back into the room with the assistance of Dimmock Cunnington, who held up his hat to shield Emma from looking at the bodies. This is really Victorian. It really is. They walked her to Hiram's corpse and placed her hand on his forehead, where she gained her composure and reportedly said, quote, "Now I can see him. I am strong now." She then walked to Joseph's body and basically just collapses. All the pressure of trying to stay strong and too much violence and all the stress she was possibly under, finally her grief just comes pouring out and she begins sobbing and groaning. "Joseph, Joseph, are you dead? Have the assassins shot you?" The four kids are gathered around, and that's got to be a traumatic thing to watch. They're obviously traumatized by the experience. As Lyndon Val sadly notes, quote, "Grief that words cannot embody seemed to overwhelm the whole group."
And here at this point, we get another sort of lore that develops. Richmond, the non-Mormon dude, claims that Emma said, "Oh, Joseph, Joseph, my husband, have they taken you from me at last?" But it's Dimmock Huntington's account, written down 24 years later in Utah under Brigham Young, where he recalls that Emma asked Joseph to forgive her, which has led to speculation what Emma would need forgiveness for. We're going to file that one under N for nonsense. Nice try, Dimmock.
It's Lucy Mack, the dead's mother, that entered the room and cried, my God, why hast thou forsaken this family?" She then sat down between both coffins and put a hand on each body.
When William Clayton goes to see them, he was really kind of emotionless about it. He said, quote, "After the bodies were laid out, I went in to see them. Joseph looks very natural, except being pale through loss of blood. Hiram does not look so natural. Now, don't worry, within a couple days, he'll be back to normal and yelling things like, quote, liberty has fled and the nation is stained with the blood of innocence. Trust us, they did not really have a happy 4th of July that year. As Mark Shearer points out, and this should be zero surprise if you've been to Nauvoo in the summer, the combo of heat and humidity really speeds up that process of deterioration, and it was very much noticeable.
And not to get too gross, you know, for our listeners out there, but like, because he was shot in the face, his wound was there, so it was really swollen, and they didn't have, I mean, people that saw the body described his face as unrecognizable. I mean,
fluid leaking out.
Fluid leaking constantly. Out. They had to catch it, and it was really nasty. So, back to Mormon Enigma. Quote, "Early the next morning, the bodies were placed on the soft white cambric lining of coffins covered in black velvet and studded with brass nails. Squares of glass in the lids protected the faces." Again, very Victorian.
Oh, yeah. Just oozing Victorianness. All right.
Don't say oozing.
Oozing was bad. The second I said it, I was like, you can't say that. Yeah, it's just screaming, this is the Victorian age, so... Okay, let's talk about the viewing for a minute. Nearly 10,000 people walked through the doors of the Nauvoo Mansion to view the bodies. 10,000. So the mourners came in through the west entrance, then through the dining room where the bodies were displayed, and then they get ushered out the north door. And this is where we get several accounts from the other wives of these men who had to mourn in secret silence. Eliza Snow recounted, quote, "To look upon the noble, lifeless forms was a sight that might well appall the heart of a true American citizen, but what it was for loving wives and children, the loyal heart may feel." B.W. Richmond witnessed Lucinda Morgan Harris convulsing with sobs over the head of Joseph Smith's body. And if you don't remember who she is, shame on you. Go listen to some more episodes.
And yet the crack in the congregation and church was already beginning to form. Joseph Smith III would later write in his memoirs, quote, "It is a source of gratification to me now to remember that no other woman bowed beside the bodies of these brothers as wives to mourn and exhibit their grief, save my mother at my father's side and Aunt Mary at the side of my Uncle Hiram. The scene was sacred to their grief and theirs alone," end quote. It is very territorial.
Someone who has no knowledge of anything that's going on behind the scenes reads that passage and is like, that's a weird thing to say.
Or someone who thinks that William Clayton's journals are frauds, maybe.
And see, the problem is their account just doesn't square with both witnesses and plural wives at the time. So sorry, Mr. Denier, I'm going to have to ask the jury to disregard your testimony. But grief is hard, and it consumed everybody in different ways. Emma was said to pace the floor back and forth the next day. If you want to watch a really moving portrayal of this period of time, I'd watch Melissa Leilani Larson's excellent film Jane and Emma, because the entire premise of that story comes from this time, and her writing showcases a heartbreaking grief where Emma is conflicted as the bride of Joseph's youth, but she has to share him with other people in the church, including his plural wives. It's pretty powerful.
This was not your average funeral. Not only was Joseph infamous at this point, there was a lot of fear that folks would come and desecrate the bodies. He had a lot of enemies. So to avoid this, when it's time to bury the bodies, friends of the Smiths filled the coffins with sandbags and buried those instead of the bodies.
The real bodies were buried under the Nauvoo house, which was unfinished at the time. But that is only the beginning of the saga of the bodies. Let's take a quick detour from our story to talk about the bodies and the burial. Curtis Weber did a pretty great article on the forensic history of the bodies. And the burials and all of that.
Yeah, and I thought I mentioned up thread, but maybe I didn't, that again, very Victorian, like they're burning sugar and molasses, so it doesn't, and tar, so you can't smell the bodies. They've got them
black
in these
black
and white with little glass frames. Joseph's body is so drained from blood that he's pale but beautiful and princely, and
hand on the forehead.
I know, all the kerchiefs were out. And then you have this idea of like these bandit robbers that are threatening, and so now they're putting dummies in the coffins and burying the coffins. So after the public viewing, Joseph and Hiram's bodies are secreted away into a room of the Nauvoo mansion while the sandbags were put into the coffins, and it was very cloak and dagger for fear of having these, you know, bodies stolen or mutilated. That night, while the world slept, a small group of men carried other coffins that contained the real bodies and buried them across the street in the basement of the Nauvoo house, which at the time was unfinished. This burial place was kept secret for a really long time, except only by family members or those that helped in this sort of secret burial.
Curtis Weber goes on to explain that later that fall, Emma has the bodies taken out of the Nauvoo House basement and then buried across the street by the homestead that's on their land. Then, just before Brigham and Company left in 1846, Emma had the bodies moved again to the Hibbard Woods down by the river. Then again, once the filthy Brighamites are out of town, the bodies are finally moved back to the homestead. Are you confused yet? As Weber points out in this article, all this shuffling around is due to a combination of fear that Joseph's body would be dug up and or mutilated, like we mentioned, but also her distrust of Brigham Young. And that should show you just how far that wedge was driven between them. She was really, truly concerned that Brigham Young would try to take the bodies west with him as part of this move to assert his control. This is not unfounded, I would argue. Now, because, like we said, this location was kept secret, when Emma dies in 1879, that knowledge just kind of goes with her. Originally, there had been this little building, think, you know, like some sort of shed that was over where they were buried, but over the years, that had just kind of disintegrated. And it seems like Joseph III also knew the exact spot, so when he dies in 1914, that's basically the last living link to the real location of where they'd been buried.
Can we talk for a minute about him, the theory that Brigham Young wanted to take the bodies with him? Wasn't it Brigham?
Or that he did?
Yeah, because he gave out pieces of Joseph's cane. Wasn't it Brigham that gave that away to people?
Yeah, they did that, and then they did the coffin canes.
He did coffin canes, and I feel like every once in a while Brigham was responsible for giving stuff out. Listeners out there, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but if that were the case, that lines up with a lot of martyrs in religious history where relics are taken, fingers are taken from martyrs, and bones are passed around. And to me, that suggests a true believer in the person's authority. So again, for the Brigham killed Joseph folks, it doesn't check out.
Well, and it's also interesting because it speaks to the importance that Mormonism has on the material world. Like, bodies are going to be resurrected.
Hair art.
So, you know, the fact that you would have the bodies with them is a symbol of, you know, your power and...
Or that you'd have death masks of your prophets on the wall in your bedroom room. Wait, no, that's just certifiable.
That's how you know you're going to make it to the celestial kingdom. And you know where...
And by the way, Brian's wife thankfully made him take it down, so...
This is creepy. Come on. There's no evidence for that.
I'm with her 100%, and so is everyone else.
What is interesting about this whole discussion of did Brigham Young take the bodies is, guess where that pops up again? Fundamentalist circles. This is a big discussion during the Joseph Musser, Lauren Woolley era. And they debate that frequently.
Oh, yeah. These relics, are, it's a huge thing with, it's actually strange. And there's actually an FLDS thing, too, where a lot of folks think that Ruland's grave down in Short Creek has been, the body has been taken.
Right.
And moved.
There was the depression in the soil. Uh-huh. Yes, yes, yes.
There's some folks that were tracking and taking photos of the cemetery and watching this because FLDS have been known to move graves in the middle of the night.
Gee, I wonder where they got that idea.
Interesting. Okay, back to Joseph and Hiram's bodies, though. The story doesn't end with Joseph III knowing where they are buried. Weber's article summarizes the next crazy chapter. So in 1913, a dam in Keokuk was built that let the waters of the unruly Mississippi River to rise. And in 1927, it threatened to encroach on the resting place of the graves. So the president of the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and descendant of Joseph Smith, Frederick M. Smith, made a decision. A civil engineer named William O. Hans was brought in to do a large-scale excavation of the gravesite so they could create a proper gravesite with a monument. And thus begins a large dig of the Smith property to locate the bodies and find the remains of Joseph Smith's wife, Emma Smith, because they didn't know quite where she was either. So on the third day of the dig, and of course, on the third day. And behold, on the third day of the dig, they found a skeleton with a comb and remnants of a dress. Hot damn, they found Emma.
And the fun part about that is she had some sort of marker over hers, except she was buried like 3 feet away. So you can see like the locations were...
Oh man, it reminds me of FLDS. Off. It's so interesting. Okay, so a couple days later, they then discovered the foundation of a little building that was this key marker like you're talking about. So bingo, under this marker are two skeletons buried underneath it. They get Fred Smith on the phone and tell everyone to hit pause until the church president could get there. And then in a move that absolutely scandalized their Utah cousins, they took the skulls to a room in the Nauvoo Mansion where they photographed and measured them. Thank goodness they did that, actually.
Oh, the Utah Mormons were horrified that they were desecrating the bodies.
But then later on, BYU did a forensic article about it.
Later on, we were okay with
it. Yeah, it was a holy relic, right? So basically, they even had witnesses when they were photographing this. They took great care. They had witnesses sign an affidavit saying that the identification of the bodies were correct. So if you go today to the Smith Family Cemetery, you'll see Joseph in the middle with Emma and Hiram on either side. However, in later decades, several folks, including prominent Community of Christ historians Ron Romig and Lachlan Mackay, who both of them are just fantastic people, they argued that, in fact, those bodies had not been identified correctly. There are all sorts of nuts and bolts as to why there is some controversy. Weber, however, concluded in a study that the 1928 identification was right, and they were buried under the correct names of the tombstones. Or are they?
This story, fascinating. It really, really interesting.
And Locke and Ron know their stuff, too. Like,
I would not say that this one is settled yet. So, yeah, part of it is the question of Hiram got shot in the nose. But then there's also some question of when they were digging them up, they accidentally hit one of them in the face with the shovel that may have made it look like a gunshot wound. So, again, there are all sorts of questions there. Really, really interesting. But in addition to all of that chaos, there's yet another historical puzzle. Because toward the end of his life, Joseph Smith had expressed a desire to have a Smith family tomb built. And of course, because we just can't have nice things in Nauvoo, there is all sorts of Indiana Jones-level talks about where it was actually located. Friend of the podcast, Joseph Johnson, did a really interesting article on this where he looks at all the possibilities that were suggested. One of them turned out to be a wine cellar, which is fun, but bzzzt. One of them was on William Law's property. We're going to go a big bzzzt on that one, and so on. I went to Nauvoo in college, and we took a picture by one of these locations. Joseph Johnston concludes that it was probably by the southeast corner of the temple, and even points out you can see part of it in that famous contemporary photo of the temple block. However, because the tomb wasn't really ready yet, no one other than maybe William Smith's wife Caroline was ever buried there, and even she got moved to another place. And I mean, lately the new one, right? That it's underneath the sidewalk in Nauvoo, and they're digging that up. And I just have to say, like, all of this sounds like the creepiest game of musical chairs ever.
Why? And someone out there can help me with this, but why are there so many bodies buried under Nauvoo streets? I mean, knowing the history of the property, that's interesting.
It seems like streets kind of stay in the same place, usually, over time. So, yeah, it's odd. And, yeah, there is constantly someone's coming up with a new idea.
Bodies were being buried and grief was being had in Nauvoo. Meanwhile, back at the scene of the crime, back in Carthage, 5 men were indicted and stood trial for the murders. But the trial took place almost a year after the fact in May of 1845. And as you would expect, just like with the burial, there's a controversy surrounding the trial that lingers to this day too. Mormons were apparently discouraged from testifying, believing that doing so would provoke violence. So there wasn't a lot of Mormon input. And plus, they were not a people that was used to getting justice lately from any of these people in the American courts. And so the lack of Mormon witnesses was said to have a negative impact on the prosecution's case. And basically all the 5 men are acquitted. Mormons were on the initial jury, which was dismissed, and then the new jury allowed the murderers to go free. There's this whole back and forth. Orville Hickman Browning led the defense and later went on to become a member of the United States Senate. But the chaos around the injustice of the trial led to some interesting cultural remnants, including Mormons today, who still very fervently believe it was a sham trial.
And maybe even more interesting than this alleged crooked justice in the trial is the lore that would follow the jurors and everyone's associated with this forever after. There are many, many, many stories passed from generation to generation about the fates of these dudes. You think I'm exaggerating? There's a book published with all these tales. The Fate of the Persecutors of the Prophet Joseph Smith by N.B. Lundwall has been giving readers bad, crappy history since 1952. It's been a really steady seller over the years. I could create a good list of all the variant titles people have come up with when they call in for it. The Fate of the Prosecutors of the Prophet Joseph Smith. The Fate of the Perpetrators of the Prophet Joseph Smith. The Fate of the Martyrs of the Prophet Joseph Smith. That's my favorite. And I once had an argument about how crappy this book was with a guy who wouldn't bother to take off his motorcycle helmet during the whole discussion. It seems about right.
Luckily for us and all Mormons everywhere, except for the dude in the motorcycle helmet, Brother Richard Polson wrote a pretty killer article about the myth and folklore that has been passed down during the years, which is just fascinating. So he details some of these myths, like this statement from Seth Howe, quote, "My grandfather was one of the leaders of the mob which murdered Joe Smith. I questioned him further as to what became of the grandfather afterwards. He related that following the assassination of Joseph Smith, his grandfather never saw a well day, although he lived for several years afterwards. His condition grew progressively worse, and physicians of the day who called to attend him were unable to diagnose it as to any known affliction, but his suffering was so intense, he frequently expressed the desire to obtain poison to end it all. His family very carefully kept anything of that nature out of his reach, and at his final demise, he actually rotted alive, finally dying in intense agony," end quote.
Yeah, and that one's a mild version. Here's another. Jack Reed, an avowed participant in the murder of Joseph Smith, meets a horrible fate. He was literally eaten alive by worms. His eyeballs had fallen out, the flesh on his cheeks and neck had fallen off, and though he could breathe, he could take nourishment only from an opening in his throat. Pieces of flesh as large as 2 hands had fallen from different parts of his body.
If you're a listener out there and you heard one of these stories, we want to hear it. These are so fascinating. They just carry on and on. Another story claims that Brigham Young cursed the mob, saying that anyone involved would, quote, utterly rot before they died. And so the stories of rotting flesh are the theme and they continue. Another theme that shows up later is the tradition of members of the mob that converted. And there kind of were, I guess, like William Daniels is touted as being in the mob that killed Joseph Smith and later converted to the church. Except his story and account reads more like an onlooker in the events than a perpetrator. He, you know, had showed up because the local militia had called the town together and he was like, what's this? What's going on? What are you guys doing? This isn't good. But the myth remains. And so many of the people that killed Joseph Smith allegedly show up in Utah and brag about it. This is a fun one, too.
Allegedly.
allegedly. And I shouldn't laugh because this becomes a huge instigator in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And just wait until we get into this period, because I've been, you know, in Juanita Brooks's papers and I have a lot to talk about. I'm going to go crazy on that. But anyway, these mobbers seem to show up in Utah bragging about being in the mob. The people that, you know, in the Baker Fancher party allegedly had the gun that killed Joseph Smith.
Which is a real smart thing to do when you're traveling through Utah.
Hostile Utah that they were afraid. Yeah.
Real smart move. Yeah.
And while we're talking about that just for a second, like you don't just have accounts from that. You have accounts from people that were little children at the time, and they remember hearing the bragging. Like it carries throughout. This is a theme that, you know, any outsider it was sort of applied to, including the Duke's party afterwards.
Remember that file of N for nonsense. That will be coming real handy later. Another story is about a guy who's in the mob who eventually makes his way to Utah. And by this point, he's just a leper. His ears, his hands were falling off, and he claimed it was a curse from God. A lot of falling flesh. Yeah. Caution, falling flesh.
He's like walking across the plains, losing limbs. Like,
but he still makes it to Utah somehow, so...
Enough to have those curse from God utter from his parched lips right before they fell to the feet of the believers. Okay, I have to give our people some grace here. These rumors have really irritated me over the years, if you can't tell, because they're not just like simple stories. They came with huge consequences for folks like the Baker and Fancher party, whose murder was justified because they were allegedly bragging about having this gun that killed Joseph Smith. But you see these rumors show up outside of massacre lore. Like I said, the Duke wagon train, a lot of Gentiles coming through the town, soldiers in the army. It got used to justify violence a lot in Utah. But they also show up everywhere else. There was a lot of fear and trauma from the events of Missouri and Carthage. And this martyrdom, this stuff that happens becomes a huge trigger for that. So I think of trauma and PTSD a lot because I'm in a trauma, working in a trauma space with a lot of traumatized people in Mormonism. And I think trauma and PTSD makes people hyper vigilant in their ideas. So you have these traumatized people in Carthage, these Mormons, and the origin of the rumor and the fear of the mobbers show up in Utah. And so it makes a lot of sense if you look at this in a lens of trauma. These stories are the result of trauma. It just doesn't make a lot of sense outside of it, though, these stories.
And not helping with the massacre lore is our guy Parley P. Pratt, who wrote that one of the dudes that got shot by Joseph's pistol, apparently in the arm, had the arm amputated, and suddenly his body started to rot from the amputation until he rotted alive. Why does everyone rot?
Well, because Brigham Young said that thing, which is ironic considering
how... This is the one time he was right? The rotting?
Well, he said it, and then I think they made it happen, you know.
A self-fulfilling falling flesh prophecy, I think is how
it's like someone has a cold. They're like, did you see that? His nose is rotting from the inside out.
Oh, such fun stuff. Falling flesh. And we should note that not only are these myths not true, even guys like Dallin Oaks and other faithful Mormon defenders and historians have noted that out of the five dudes who get indicted for the murder, you got Thomas Sharp, Jacob Davis, Levi Williams, Mark Aldrich, and William Grover. Guess what? They all go on and live successful lives and careers, mayors, upstanding citizens. Zero pieces of flesh fall from any of them.
Until they walk to Utah.
Until they walk to Utah and their tongue falls out.
The roads are the dustiest, the winds are the gustiest, the gates are the rustiest, the pies are the crustiest, the songs the lustiest, the friends the trustiest, way back home.
Back home.
The funeral of Joseph Smith was strange in many senses. Not only was there the simmering rage and blatant grief, but people on both sides of the Mormon divide didn't know if they were going to go to war or not. This was very real. John Taylor, Governor Ford, and Emma Smith were really trying hard to keep folks from avenging the prophet in that moment, because a lot of people did. They wanted to do that. But they promised peace, and yet, leave it to W.W. Phelps, man. He has to go and stir things up.
Old Serpent Face himself.
He put the drama in temple drama.
He certainly did. Sliding across the floor with every beat of his heart.
It's just very dramatic.
And this is why historians Richard Van Wagner and Stephen Walker called Phelps's funeral sermon weird. And they point out that first, as he's speaking, the wagons with sandbag Joseph and Hiram are passing by, so that's an interesting element. Then for Phelps himself, they noted that choosing him to give the eulogy was, quote, strange, the content of a sermon stranger, the tone of that sermon strangest of all. Okay, here's the thing. We don't have the exact content of his sermon. He recorded what he remembered saying almost a decade later, which probably means he embellished it a bit. And where have I heard that about Phelps before? 1838, polygamy revelation, perhaps? And the sermon is strange considering Phelps was part of the committee charged with keeping the peace in Nauvoo.
I wish we had time and energy to read the entire sermon because it's full of comparisons to, we've been telling you to wait for it, Joseph Smith to Jesus Christ. We can thank old W.W. Phelps for those. Quote, "Saints and sinners, thus said John on the Isle of Patmos, and thus I say in Nauvoo, two of the greatest and best men who have lived on the earth since the Jews crucified the Savior have fallen victims to the popular will of mobocracy in this boasted asylum of the oppressed, the only far-famed realms of liberty or freedom on the globe, and the sword of justice that ought to glitter with vengeance to repel such an insult to humanity, and the rich boon of life and the free pursuit of happiness hangs in the closet. And the stately robes of judgment that might clothe the sons of the freemen with brief authority to wipe off the stain of innocent blood shed by a Philistine clergy and a hypocritical people from our nation there issue." What is that word?
Our national escutcheon.
Escutcheon. What they the really, hell is an escutcheon?
It's like the shield where you put your coat of arms.
Settle down, W.W. Yeah. Phelps. Mm-hmm. Calm they it really down, like the buddy. Word escutcheon. "From our national escutcheon hangs there too, and there they will hang till Jehovah comes out of his hiding place and vexes the nation with a sore vexation. For, righteously speaking, this people are lingering with the consumption, like seamen with the scurvy on a board of a cruiser 7 years out, and the demagogue sharks are gliding in the wake to swallow their victims as soon as they drop from the plank to the sea, so passes the world in wickedness." End quote. I'm done.
Sharks, sure, but I think it's more like you jumping them, not that they're trying to bite the Mormons. "And what shall I say of the prophet? The prince of light, he that pointed out the faults of the wisdom of men and demonstrated the folly of the philosophy of ages, he that cut the chain cable of Christian convenience with the sword of the spirit as if it had been a silken thread in the blaze of a candle, he that cut the Gordian knot of bastard matrimony with its same scissors that Peter used to clip the Gentile locks and Jewish curls that grew and flourished in families by order of Nimrod, Nebuchadnezzar, and Caesar, he that took truth for his pruning knife, virtue for his coat of mail, and God for his guide, and undertook to prune the vineyard of the Lord for the last time? What? In this age of inventions, flying intelligence, and self-shining glory, what shall I say of Joseph the seer, whose innocent blood stains the land of freedom, stains the halls of legislation, stains the judge's bench, stains the priest's pulpit, and stains the nation's panoply? Yet what shall I say of this patriot of purity? I will say, he was all he was, the agent of Jehovah to call on all flesh to settle the trespass committed upon the word of the Lord, and call for satisfaction for the forcible expulsion by the powers of church and state of the holy priesthood, and to make men render an account of the deeds done in this body, whereby the sacred order of matrimony had been corrupted, and he came not from the hotbeds of college arts and university science to invent new creeds and enlarge the breach of division, but he came without the stolen thunder of some pretty prince of this world. To wake admiration, yes, he came self-made and fired his own earthquakes to summon the world to judgment. He came, not in a tempest of wrath, but in the still small voice of Jehovah, with full power to restore the holy priesthood. He came not in the whirlwind of public opinion, but in the simple name of Jesus Christ, with love that surpasses understanding, to form a union that astonishes all the powers that be, and sets the priesthood of Baal at defiance. And all hell howls with a host of hired servants to kick up for them. Jeez, Phelps, settle down, man.
I'm sorry, this is an Arby's. I feel like you go to the temple and you see Phelps be Satan in the temple. And then you see him get up and give this speech. And you're just like, that guy's dramatic. He really likes the role. Like, he puts the drama in temple drama.
If I remember right, when he recreates the sermon, it's like the Deseret Drama Association or something. So they were probably like critiquing him on his performance and like.
I mean, I don't want to make fun of a sacred funeral eulogy for a religious figure. However, I will, because W.W. Phelps, you know, he embellished it.
It's a little much.
But even if he embellished it later, you know, it was as embellished and dramatic when he gave it because that was his brand. It's what he liked to do. And again, I'm sorry. I get resentful of it because I've seen how many prophets do we know from breakoff groups who die? And, you know, this kind of charged rhetoric comparing Joseph to Jesus Christ, it's not helpful. it's hurt a lot of people. You talk to a lot of missionaries that internalize that stuff on their missions, and I don't know, not a fan. Anyway, we literally only chose two paragraphs from the sermon because it is buck wild. If Phelps did deliver words just like this, it was either riveting or really bizarre. Again, imagine seeing him play Satan, and you know he got into that role. I've seen one other man do it when they did live sessions, an elderly gentleman in Salt Lake Temple that was really into it, and that's how I picture Phelps. So he was either that or super bizarre. Either way, it didn't help keep things peaceable in Nauvoo. Let's just say that. He compares Governor Buhis Boggs and Governor Ford to Cain, Judas, and Nimrod. He talks about corrupt governments, all the stuff you can expect from a good old-fashioned Mormon sermon. And if you want to know why there are so many anti-American government sentiments still around in Mormonism, just read the sermon.
And all of this brings us back to a larger issue. No matter where you situate yourself on the Mormon spectrum, this story really should invoke some sense of pathos or tragedy.
You can be an ex-Mormon or a never-Mormon and absolutely hate Joseph Smith and even take solace in his death. But the tragedy in this isn't just the loss of a life of a man. It's about how the impact of his teachings and his death gilded the memory of a martyr and still inspires very many people for better or worse. The violence of his death inspired so much violence within Mormonism, and that I can say safely. It becomes a major excuse given to justify things like Mount Meadows Massacre. It becomes part of a temple oath that would be uttered on the lips of your sweet grandmothers. I think about that sometimes, right? That you have this grandmother that's like knitting and then she's going down to the temple doing this violent oath. Yeah, it's so interesting and scary. It's evoked violent expressions in Mormon fundamentalist extremism, and it continues to entrench Mormons in a persecution narrative that does a lot of damage. And worse, in my opinion, is that it made a god out of a very, very, very flawed man.
You can find tragedy there. Or if you're a faithful adherent to the teachings of Joseph Smith, somebody who finds beauty, comfort in his life, an example, it inspires a pain that someone you love, who has improved your life, was taken away like this. No matter how you look at it, from whatever position, there is a continuance of grief from violence.
And that's where we'll leave you tonight, to ponder on the vibrations that pain can carry out through generations. It can be a cautionary tale to the impact that our own violence can have well beyond in our own lives. I mean, I brought this up just the other day. If you've been following Mormon online stuff, you've got Brad Wilcox, who gave a fireside. And to me, his anger and his urgency and his black and white thinking are signs of trauma. That's how the traumatized brain acts. It's very black and white, and it can't see other options. And that was Brad's sermon. He's still traumatized by his Mormon experience and generations of Mormon trauma. The violence and the trauma comes from moments like this, and it's carried on and it's passed down in these cultural stories and theologies. But for the sake of this podcast, it's a good bridge to understand our next episode, where we're going to explore what generational trauma looks like in Mormonism and outside of just firesides. A theme of mine since podcasting is talking about this generational trauma, because it's so easy for me doing podcasts in a chronological order to see how the violence of early Mormonism absolutely connects and continues to shape our psyches today. Nowhere are the signs of trauma more present in the diverging paths of the Restoration than after the death of the Smith boys.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine.
Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. It's the Books of Mormon's report. For the funeral and the burial, as always, check out Mormon Enigma. They do an excellent job of narrating all these moving parts and empathetically showing what this meant to Nauvoo and, of course, obviously what it meant to Emma. And for the trial and all of that, Carthage Conspiracy will probably end up being the best thing that Dallin Oaks ever writes. I think that's a really safe bet these days.
Sister, don't go away, sister. Brother Brigham, Brother Young, won't you send destroying Danites, Brother Young? Spill my blood upon the earth, oh Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I
beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
But only the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.